Hello, everybody, and thank you so much for tuning in to the Beyond the Bars Radio Podcast, part of the Mental Health News Radio Network. My name is Rob Lohman, your host, and all I want to say is buckle your seatbelts, everybody, because we're going to be talking about the real issues behind addiction and incarceration. You know those great dinner conversations you love to have, but we're going to talk about breaking the stigma and helping people move from addiction and incarceration into recovery and transformation. You're going to hear from experts around the world that talk about how addiction is infiltrating their communities. We're going to hear from passionate parents that lost a child to addiction and amazing people that are in recovery and tell you their wonderful stories to encourage and inspire people to press on and never give up no matter what. That's what this show is all about. The show is all about hope. It's all about change. And this show would not be possible unless we had the amazing sponsors. Thank you so much to Lifted from the Rut Addiction Services, where they provide intervention and recovery coaching services to families, individuals, and businesses. Learn more at liftedfromtherut.com. And we also want to say thank you to the Rock Transformational House. It is a 7-month program where men coming out of addiction or just want to turn around and focus their life on Jesus Christ for a season. Learn more at therocktransformationalhouse.com. Thank you all so much. God bless and enjoy the show. Hey, everybody. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Beyond the Bars Radio Podcast. I'm your host, Rob Lohman, and I'm real excited for everyone to hear from Craig DeRoche with Prison Fellowship. He has an amazing story and does amazing advocacy out in the community across the nation. So, Craig, welcome to the podcast, and why don't you go ahead and just kind of give people a little intro on yourself.
Well, Rob, thank you, by the way, and thank you for all your listeners. It's great to be with you. It's great to be alive and sober today and carrying a flag for the cause. I tell people I got involved. A lot of people say, how did you come from being in an elective office to working in criminal justice reform and addiction public policy? And I say the same way that the founder of Prison Fellowship, Chuck Colson, did. I got arrested. And try to keep it light, people laugh, but there's a lot to be said for that, you know, I get the privilege of being one of these people in this movement that is using my experience to help other people. And I think that's a great tradition. And I think that our experience is really beneficial. It's unlocking a lot of the solutions that our culture is seeking today.
Yeah, I can totally appreciate what you said there. And what is your current role with Prison Fellowship? And let's go back to when you were back as a Republican leader and the huge transition that happened in your life then.
Yeah, absolutely. My current position at Prison Fellowship is I'm the Senior Vice President of Public Policy and Advocacy. And I gave your listeners a little bit of a preview of how I got there. But what I was known for, the public facing side of my work before when I was younger in my 20s and 30s, was being a hard charging, successful business person who got involved in politics. I was elected twice to a city council in a town called Novi, Michigan. Stop number 6 on the stagecoach route is where it got its name, NO period Roman numeral VI. But it was the fastest growing upper middle class suburb in Michigan. And I got elected to the city council when I was 27 and reelected. And then I ran to represent that city and 6 other cities in the state legislature when I was 32 and was elected to the legislature. And nobody even ran against me, kind of a funny circumstance. And then 2 years later, my colleagues, all the other state representatives, saw fit to elect me the Speaker of the House. So I became a statewide leader at age 34, had a very national, high national profile because I was the youngest Republican statewide leader at the time in the country until Bobby Jindal was elected governor of Louisiana some time later. And so I had a lot of attention on me. Michigan had a lot of attention on the state because we were the only state that had not come out of the recession after 9/11. And people were leaving in droves, packing up their cars, and our manufacturing jobs were leaving. And we had a Democratic governor, Jennifer Granholm, and I was a Republican speaker. And we did battle over budgets and taxes and things like that. So it was a very stressful, difficult time, a very high position, very honored to hold it. And what nobody knew about me was I was actually living in addiction, you know, that I had been fighting addiction to alcohol since I was a little kid. And I even went to rehab while I was Speaker of the House for 5 days without anybody knowing about it. And that didn't help me. It didn't help anybody else. But, you know, it's part of my story and it's part of who made me what I am today. And I was term limited out of office. I left in 2008, going in 2009, January 1 of 2009. And I thought I could resume my business activities and make up for lost time. And but my alcoholism was catching up with me. It's progressive for me. And it was in a pretty bad state. So I went about trashing a bunch of relationships and my own marriage and failing, you know, in the business ventures that I pursued. And my drinking only got worse and it culminated into me being arrested in a pretty high profile way. In pretty ridiculous incidents. Nobody was hurt, thank God. But I was that guy in 2010, both in February, it was in, I think, 275 newspapers. And then I violated my probation and was arrested on a new charge in June of 2010, just 4 months later, in another spectacularly stupid event. And I was that guy. I was on Fox News, CNN. I had helicopters over my house. I got the full, as I say, the Charlie Sheen, Lindsay Lohan treatment for my erratic behavior, and lost everything. Found, you know, I didn't have anything left but to focus on recovery. And when I found recovery, I started bearing witness to what was possible with other people. And Chuck Colson, who founded Prison Fellowship, heard about my story, heard about what I was talking about, and said, "Now this is interesting. A conservative Republican who's actually lived in addiction himself for decades, who's been a Speaker of the House, is talking about things that are important public policy changes." And he came to me and said he thought God had a bigger plan for me and that I could use my experience to benefit other people, which was amazing to me because my experience was such a low bottom. And I said I would help because I felt that it was God's promise that we could use that experience, painful as it is, for the benefit of other people. And that was back in 2011 in the fall. And so I've been trying to help ever since working at Prison Fellowship.
Wow, that's quite the story, especially to be, you know, just approached, I guess, by Chuck Colson. And since you were in the political world, maybe that wasn't as big a deal for you. But I think listeners would be like, that's pretty amazing that you would be sought out by a guy that was radically transformed by his own prison experience and God. And
he was an amazing guy. And he put me right in, too, by the way, for your listeners. The first day I met him, he said, "Craig, I'm nearly 80 years old." It was about 10:30 at night. He had just come back from Washington, D.C. And here's a tidbit. I never get to say this with anybody, but I'll share it with your listeners. He had told me that he and John Kerry had a discussion that night. Senator John Kerry, who had run for president. And he said that they both agreed that it was time to bury the hatchet. And so I'll share that with your listeners. So I got to meet Chuck on the day that these two had been going at each other since Nixon was president and John Kerry was a protester for all those years. And he said to me that he was tired after that discussion and dinner, and he wanted me to pinch hit for him the next day with the U.S. Senate. And I was overwhelmed by that, but he assured me that the Spirit would lead me and I'd be fine. And so I did that. And it's just been a real privilege. He's a fascinating guy, and I really miss him. I think he would be amazed at the fruit that is born today from the work that he poured into this movement over the 40 years of his life after he left prison.
That's beautiful. Thanks. Thank you for giving us the inside scoop there. But that's a pretty powerful day that you just shared right there. You know, you mentioned a little bit about kind of the process of recovery. Can you share what, because a lot of people that tune in, they, you know, have a loved one that's suffering from addiction. They don't know how to help somebody. They've tried all these different things, but what did your, I guess, as you said, the process of recovery look like, and how did you find community in recovery, especially in your position?
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, Robin, and you know this, and many of your listeners too, but for those that are out there that are struggling in addiction themselves today or have loved ones, I know that pain well, and I know it firsthand. I know the pain that I inflicted on others, my parents, my wife, my children. Having to see my parents, my brother, who has a a job that requires him to have a good name, you know, with all the damage I did in the newspapers and everything. But I also know the loss of addiction. My younger brother, Kurt, passed away on September 12, 2012, more than 2 years after I got sober. He was back from Afghanistan and was on prescription drugs from the VA and had an accidental overdose from those. And he was struggling in addiction prior to that as well. And so I know how difficult it is, that line of what we can do as other people, as well as what is needed for the person. So if it's okay, Rob, I'll talk about what happened in me and what made a difference, and maybe some of the suggestions of what clicked in me could help people help other folks. And I learned the most powerful thing for me about addiction recovery from a kids class that the Betty Ford Center put on at the Brighton Center for Recovery in Michigan, where I was there for a 30-day stint. And Betty Ford had done this class for 6 to 12-year-olds. So that's a start for your listeners. I needed to have this explained to me, where they were, in essence, explaining addiction to my children, and for me to finally understand it. And the exercise, Rob, was this. We got the kids were doing their exercises while the parents had to do our own exercises that day. We were separate. And when we came together, the kids had painted rocks, and they said things like fear and anger and guilt and shame and other things like that on the rocks. And they were carrying around burlap sacks the whole time they were doing their activities, and they didn't know why. They were empty. And then the kids sat down in front of all of us, and they said, who knows what fear is? And the kids would raise their hand. Okay, give me a fear. And with each one, they would say, like, I'm afraid of tornadoes. They'd say, great, take a rock and put that fear in Johnny's bag, one person's bag they're picking on. And who's got anger? You know, well, this, that. Who's been ashamed? You know, who knows what that is? And they kept putting rocks in his bag until Johnny couldn't pick up the bag anymore. And they said, your parents are here because they've spent their whole life accumulating rocks in their bag. And they haven't known how to get rid of the rocks in their bag. And so they turned to alcohol and drugs. So the bag didn't bother them as much. And at first that worked. They forgot about the bag. It was easier to carry. But pretty soon the drinking and the drugs, they needed more and more, and then it got worse. It didn't help them forget about the bag. And then it got even worse that the drinking and the drugs started putting more rocks in the bag, and they didn't know how to get out of it. So they're here to learn how to get those rocks out of their bag in a healthy way. And so they will never have to drink and drug again, because drinking and drugging wasn't their problem. It was their solution to their problem. And they're here to learn a different solution. And I about fell out of my chair. I thought, how come nobody told me that in third grade? You know, that's so simple. You know, I started when I was 10, 11, 12 years old looking for solutions to my problems, and alcohol made perfect sense to me. You know, it helped me avoid those issues. It helped me deal with them, forget them, whatever you want to talk about, instead of me developing healthy alternatives. And so I just thought I'd share a little bit about my own personal walk there and what I learned. I went into an inpatient. I was blessed. I know how difficult that is for people to find and to get help with. I also know the challenges there. The first time I went in, I was the Speaker of the House. I was trying to hide out from the public. I was in there for 5 days, and I thought I could learn my way through it. I read every book they gave to me. I scheduled every counseling session I could do, because I looked at it like I was going to the doctor and saying, I've had this broken ankle and I need you to set it. I'll do whatever you want to get the ankle fixed, you know, 6 weeks of this, 8 weeks of that, so I can get back on the field. And that was the way I looked at it, which is completely wrong and completely backward. In essence, what I was saying is, I want to stay the same person that has the same flaws. I just don't want to drink anymore. And I know some people have been successful in that in their life, but I think they've cut themselves short of being set free of those problems. I tried that. I failed. I would go back in and out of drink. I didn't drink all that much when I was speaker from that day forward, though. I kind of white knuckled it, as your listeners would talk about, until I got out of office. And the second time I went in, I was turned off by all the substitute drugs that everybody was taking. You know, they say they're not intoxicating or addictive, but it seemed like everybody was looking for their next bump. I didn't like that at all. And, you know, it's probably fairly judgmental on my part, but it prevented me from listening. So I know that the people, sometimes you'll hear this maybe on your show frequently, people say it takes what it takes, but I was very selfish and I was trying to solve it my own way. And so I never slowed down and listened to what was available to me the whole time, which was to listen to the people, the experience that were there to help me unwind these things. And once I'd finally hit a very low bottom, as I kind of described to you there, I was all ears. And it turned out the things they probably told me the first two times I was in rehab, they told me the third time, but the difference is I listened and it made a lot of sense. And I just started following other people's direction and putting one foot in front of the next. And my life started getting supernaturally better.
That's amazing. How long were you in treatment the third time? What was your duration then?
They actually kicked me out after 29 days. I wanted to stay for the 30th day. And by that point, that's how willing I was. I was like, you know, you're telling me that I got to leave. You know, they told me that in the 28th day. And I said, but tomorrow's the 29th day. And they said, we need the bed. You're doing great. And I was like, but I want to be here now. Yeah. So I had the privilege of being there. And that's part of my story. I wrote it in a memoir because, you know, the place I went to is called the Brighton Center for Recovery. And it's one of these places that a lot of famous and rich people go to, you know, like Betty Ford and Hazelden and some of the other better known ones. It has a great program, but attracts people from all over the world. And, you know, Eminem and other people would go through it. You know, I had the privilege of being in there with a bunch of people that own businesses and were leading professionals in all sorts of different ways. But my behavior and the choices I made with my family and friends with the police with my lifestyle were all the same, you know, so as everybody else. And I thought it would be really important because I saw a lot of people that the society calls highly functional as being treated differently, or if they were like me thinking I did believe I was different than other people, that maybe I had a leg up, that I was smarter or more talented or accomplished, I'd be able to figure this out differently, or that I was afflicted differently. And I wanted to share that experience. So I wrote a memoir called Highly Functional, which describes what the life of somebody that did some extraordinary things that you would think in the material world as extraordinary, what the addiction life during that time actually looked like. It wasn't very functional at all, but also to give these type of insights to people that have fear today. Maybe there's people listening that are saying, how would I do this? I run an office, you know, for this national company with 30 employees in my charge, or I've started my own business, or I'm a single mom, or I'm a local city council person or a teacher. And they think that, it's better for them to stay private and try to figure it out on their own. And I've seen too many people die that way and to do some really tragically bad things by staying in their addiction. And so I, you know, I try to, in my spare time, use my experience to help people in that on that front too.
That's great. Where can people find a copy of The Highly Functional? Is it on, is it all out there on Amazon and everything?
Yeah, it should be available on Amazon. They can also, if you know, I'm not the best book salesperson in the world, so I'm not sure if this is the best method, but I do it anyway because it was written to help people. So if people don't want to buy the book, they can just go to my website, craigdaroche.com, and join the mail list, and they'll start getting two or three chapters emailed to them a day for like 20 days or however long it gets, you know, for the whole book to be emailed to them, because I wanted people to have access to it too. So you can buy the book and I'd love you to do that. But I didn't want people to think that I was trying to hold people up for money, because this is a cause that I believe so fervently in.
And how do you, can you spell, just spell your, spell that for people so you get it spelled correctly on your first and last name?
Yeah, it's Craig, C-R-A-I-G, DeRoche, com, CraigDeRoche.com. And you know, you the Google will probably autocorrect you too. Not too many people with similar names to mine in the last part of it, but come on out and check it out. And if you've got some highly functional stories of your own, share them. You know,
yeah, you can say not many people have the same name, but not many people have the same story. So they can. That's quite the story that you have, I will say. So thanks for being. I just appreciate your vulnerability and candidness. But I think some people, when they're in positions, you know, of power and leadership, obviously you've worked through that, but can, like you said, you went through that in the beginning, kind of like the shame and trying to hide everything, but now it's out there. So why not embrace the story that God gave you to, which obviously led you to do the great work that you're doing with Prison Fellowship. So, you know, not being ashamed of our story and our past, but making the most of it is pretty much what you've done. Would you agree?
Yeah. And I think God kind of helped me with that. You know, anonymity wasn't an option for me. I mean, the exposure was crazy. And I've had the privilege of being in a lot of newspapers over the last several years in the reform work. But, you know, on the front page of a Google search on my name, it's still the arrest that I was arrested for that was actually dismissed by the court. You know, so I know what that shame and that pain feels like, you know, that it's still out there. And my instincts were to try to do everything I could to explain myself out of the situation or to rationalize it or justify it or to erase it somehow. Again, I think that what I learned for me is that if that was the case, I might end up, you know, I could be dead for all I know right now. I certainly wouldn't be married in a part of my children's life or being in this position to help other people. So it's an important chasm to cross. And I would encourage your listeners that if they have fear about that, to remember that the greatest stories in the Bible, whether it be Moses who murdered Egyptians 40 years before he helped people in the Exodus, if, you know, King David, whether it was Saul of Tarsus who became Paul that wrote half of the New or a quarter of the New Testament, you know, who stoned the first martyr in Christendom. You know, people, God uses all sorts of people, and it's the worst things we do, quote unquote, the worst, that might be of the highest value of the person that we can become. And so that's where I spend a lot of my time in talking about those second chances and encouraging people that what is holding them back, that fear, might actually be the fuel that brings them and rockets them to the life they never thought was imaginable, let alone available to them today, Rob. And try to encourage people with that. But I know personally how tough that is to cross that chasm.
Yeah, I know through my own incarceration, I know my wife has had to go through a ton of her own processes with shame and anger and guilt and just from my own mistakes that I made in my life. Can you talk a little bit kind of how you and your wife maybe worked through a lot of that as a couple? Because I know addiction tears a lot of people apart for sure. A lot of families apart. Just even making poor decisions, as my decision was not in addiction, but it was more on a mental health breakdown issue. But can you talk a little bit about maybe what you all went through to give some people some encouragement to press in and press through things together?
You know, in my case, in my relationship with my wife Stacy, we're back together and we're happily married. But I don't want anybody to think that I believe that has to be the answer, you know, of where they are in their own walk right now. Because the only reason I think that we're married today is because I gave up on our marriage. You know, that I recognized that I wasn't going to stay alive, that I wasn't ever going to get sober, that I was never going to be a good person to anybody if I didn't focus on my recovery first. So I had something to give to other people. And that's what actually, in the case of me and my relationship with my wife, attracted her back to me. Our marriage was over. She had told me that when we were in counseling at the rehab institute. It was very clear, you know, and what I tell people, because I work in a Christian ministry, is that she was leaving me for all the right reasons. There wasn't anything on her side of the ledger that showed that she was giving up on me too soon or that she was being a bad mom or anything. quite the opposite. She was worried about the safety of the kids, the deceit that I had lived in for 12 years of our marriage, and all of the problems that I had brought on, and the repeated failures of promises that were violated only to be returned to drinking, and more lies and more failure and more shame and humiliation. And as I say, risking of the kids and everything else. So we hit a very low bottom, and we had to, you know, she was moving toward a divorce. And when people go into recovery, they say recovery needs to be the most important thing in your life today. You know, and not only today, from that day that you're first deciding to go into it, but really stay the most important thing in your life for the rest of your life. I thought that that was kind of a hokey statement. But for me, I don't know that I would have made it, you know, if I tried to say, you know, I'm going to go into recovery, but I'm going to do it to save my marriage, or I'm going to try to save my marriage is where my priority is. And I'll, you know, then I'll make my recovery steps fit into it. I wouldn't have saved my marriage, and I wouldn't have gotten sober. If I tried to say I'm worried about custody of the kids and posturing for that, which I had no basis for with my two arrests, if your listeners read my book or Google and see it, she would have had a great case, you know? So I just gave up, and I said, you know what? I maybe I'll be good to somebody someday, but only if I get sober first, and the rest of it will be whatever the rest of it will be. And it turns out in my case that we work through things, but my wife is a saint, because her resolve and her love through this has just been amazing. And she, the stuff that she had to endure, she had people that didn't know her stopping her, like in grocery stores, and telling her that she needed to, you know, divorce that monster that that people had read about in the newspaper, me, you know, the shame of going out in public everywhere she went. And so she had a really, really, really difficult ride. So I can only imagine what your listeners are going through right now, because we've been there. We had the child protective services, because my second arrest was a gun charge while intoxicated. They came and created a file on my wife in saying, and I heard about this. We were separated at the time, and I was in rehab, and they came and interviewed me. And I said, you know, like, this is, you know, my file, I'll get you this. And they said, no, this is a file related to what's going on in your home environment. And I was shocked, and she was mortified, and she had done nothing wrong. And I had brought that pain onto her. So all I can say, Rob, is I understand what this is like. And in my life, the answer was just to follow those 12 steps, to try to follow what I learned in my decision with the higher power of being God in the Christian sense that I came to know and understand and love, but also the good people around me that didn't quote scripture and didn't quote the 12 steps, but had gone through this themselves, that I could model my behavior after theirs, lift myself up out of it, not doing it my own way, but in their way, to get to a point in relatively short order where my wife told me that she barely recognized me, that I was a different person. And I started crying. She started crying. I don't think she knew fully what that meant to me. But that's the word she chose to say months later, is that I was unrecognizable. And that's still today probably the most important thing that anybody's ever said to me in my life. And we're together now. 7 years later, with a much different relationship.
Well, thank you for that. I think it's important for people to just to hear the different journey people go through as couples. So I appreciate you sharing that, for sure. That was important for me to hear too. So, and I know you mentioned this earlier about your brother. I didn't want to skate over that either, but I just sorry to hear about your brother passing away in 2012. Also, I'm sure that was a difficult time for your whole family, and it's never easy to lose someone, especially through life's traumas. They get hooked on pain pills and things to just kind of deal with life. And then accidentally it kind of takes over. So I know a lot of people lose a family member that way. So sorry to hear you lost your brother that way.
Well, thank you. I just, I wanted your listeners to know that, you know, they're not alone. We don't know what our course is or our path for all of us that are in this. It's sometimes a family issue. My father, got sober in 1985 when I was 15. When we talk about these things, that they're real. And while I have a great story of a second chance, and I get to use this experience to help other people, that I wanted your listeners to know that that gritty reality of the struggles, and even the struggles of the damage that I created 7 years ago, that I'm still mopping up, that my life, you know, wasn't all pixie dust where everything turned out perfect the next day. And that we just go forward, and we try to use those experiences of the losses that we accumulate, hopefully for the benefit of our own education and our own learning, but to use those to help other people. And that's why it's okay for me to share it. It's actually a privilege for me to share it, because he was a special guy, and I love him, and I miss him. But I don't want that to be in vain. I want people to know that there's other options that are available, and that when they're listening to me talk, that I understand what they're going through, and I understand the stakes.
Well, yeah. So thank you for sharing that too. Back in 2000, let's see, it was 2014. I was kind of familiar with Prison Fellowship, but not so much as far as just kind of knowing what you guys do. And then a friend of mine at church said, you should reach out to a good friend of mine, Dan, or a new friend of mine, Dan, who works with Prison Fellowship. And he introduced me to John Byrne when they were doing some, with Jesse Weiss, when he was doing the Second Chances Project. And then I found out how awesome your organization was, and got really involved in the Second Chance movement. And I know you've mentioned that term a few times since we've been talking. And last April, I was able to go to the state capitol here when they had the Second Chance hearing to try to make Second Chance Month, at least in Colorado, but also on a national basis. And I got to meet a lot of great senators, a lot of great House representatives, and they passed the bill, or I think it's correct, the bill to make Second Chance Month in Colorado for April. So that's coming up here pretty soon. But kind of tell people about what's going on around the country with Second Chance, because it's such a beautiful term, you know, for people that have been incarcerated, and just reducing the stigma out there for families and for individuals. But what's going on out there in the Second Chance world? How can people get plugged into what's going on in that movement?
Thanks so much for that, Rob. And I'm going to embarrass you a little bit when I talk about this, because I want your podcast listeners to know that you're not just a man of eloquent words in this wonderful platform that you've created. Second Chance Month is really for Prison Fellowship, the culmination of everything we've been doing for 41 years. You know, Chuck Colson got a second chance when he got out of prison after going in a Watergate-related investigation. He recognized that he was in a privileged position, and that other people would not have that chance. And this is back when our country only had a couple hundred thousand people in prison. And he said, this is awful, you know, that we're not valuing these lives and the potential. It's not consistent with our faith as Christians. It has nothing to do with that American story of second chances, you know, that we learn our lessons, we do what the court says, we're held accountable, we move forward. You know, so everything we've done at Prison Fellowship, all of our programs are geared at giving people the tools they need to succeed in their second chance, right? But the society, for those 40 years while we've been teaching people to succeed and to have that personal transformation in our academies, and I think we're at 77 academies now in 28 states at Prison Fellowship. We're on our way to 90 plus this year in a bunch more states, and we'll be in all 50 states in like 8 years from now. And we have 100 or 250,000 plus people in the Angel Tree program, and, you know, with the family connections, we do all these big programs preparing people for that second chance. And we've been advocating that whole time to be a voice for the voiceless, the people that are in prison saying, where's my lobbyist? Where are my, you know, high powered people on the Hill? And Prison Fellowship, Chuck Colson kind of served in that role because he was the political director for a president. And we built an organization around that. So when he passed away, that it isn't one person anymore, it's the whole of the organization. And so we created these products like or initiatives like Justice Declaration, where there's more than 3,000 pastors that declare what justice is, you know, so we can say what we're fighting for. We started Second Chance Month out of these stories of people like Chuck Colson and the in the thousands. We actually have had more than 10 million Angel Tree Christmases since we started Angel Tree, and said, let's actually amplify these voices, put a name to it, and call it Second Chance Month. And we started this ragtag at Prison Fellowship in 2017, even though we're a pretty, you know, substantial national organization with hundreds of employees. And I've told you the scope of the programming and the volunteers that make all that happen. And we said, let's actually throw this bread in the river and let's see where God takes it. And people like Rob, your own Rob Lohman here, took that opportunity and went out in this country. And we had, just as you said, what you did in Colorado was the planting the seed that the states could find a way to agree for once after 40 years of this talk of basically encouraging failure when someone goes into their sentence and into their incarceration, where the public would tolerate saying, we want them to be punished while they're there. We want them to longer sentences, you know, prevented from, you know, food stamps or housing and, you know, jobs, et cetera. The 48,000 barriers, actually, Rob, that we've created in our culture, that once you've done everything a judge asks you to do, which should be honored as a deal, we say there's 48,000 barriers that you will have against you in the United States of America until the day you die. You cannot be a citizen again. You cannot, you can never pay it back. And that's immoral. That's a moral flaw in the way that we operate. And we said, let's declare Second Chance Month. Let's do it in April, because April is when we still have a majority Christian population in America, majority Christian public elected leaders in the Republican and Democratic parties, and remind people around Easter that we all get a second chance. Maybe what we did didn't violate the laws of our land, but we all needed a second chance at that cross. And say this in a positive way, it took off beyond our wildest imagination. The United States Senate unanimously declared a Second Chance Month last year. Colorado, as you pointed out, Maine, Michigan, Minnesota, just for the M's, and a bunch of other people. We had events all over the country. Reporters started picking up on it. Jared Kushner, in probably the campaign in modern history since Nixon, the most tough on crime law and order campaign we've seen in our country, actually in their own White House said, this is different. These are our values and we care about this. Jared Kushner led that effort. I was privileged to go into some of those meetings with Prison Fellowship and other organizations. And the president even this year declared that he believes that when people return from prison, they should get a second chance. So Rob, without your effort, without this ragtag group of people, all the churches, all the volunteers, your listeners that helped us get off on the right foot last year, we would never be where we are today in just 1 year, where the president of the United States in a State of the Union address and both parties in Congress are saying it's time for us to come together around second chances. And to me, that means we're coming together around the potential of all of the lives of the people that are in recovery, are serving or have served in the criminal justice system, that are listening, and for all of your listeners that have hope for the people that they love that aren't there yet, of what's possible for them. I'm an evangelist, as you can tell, Rob. I think we're at the beginning of something very important here.
Yeah, well, it's very exciting, especially for me, you know, having spent time behind bars for, you know, a short period of time, but long impact. And when I was at that second chance hearing, and I could hear from both sides of the coin, so many people talking about their desires for helping people that suffer from addictions and people that have been incarcerated and the challenges that they face, it was real encouraging for me and real emotional too, because I was able to share my story in a brief moment with these representatives and senators that would, you know, come off the platform. And they just said, you know, thank you so much for coming. And I was able to ask them just kind of a pointed question about my restitution issue. I know you and I got to talk about that a little bit after the conference last year, and I got to hang out with your whole crew at your little place that you all rented for your own employee retreat. I left there real encouraged. You know, I sit here and face this this big mountain of a large restitution that I owe for my, you know, momentary lapse of reasoning. And, you know, that could potentially, you know, follow me till I die based on this large 12% interest rate that the state of Colorado imposed. And I know in the end result that there's movements and advocacy to get that changed. And, but just seeing all how there was really this united front to say, we need to come up with a better way instead of putting everyone behind bars to get them really, truly rehabilitated. And I know you guys are doing a huge effort in that. So,
yeah. And we're, and thank you for your willingness to be transparent and share that with your listeners. And I just so your listeners know, when we hear stories about that, two things from what you just said, Rob. First of all, I want all of your listeners to know that you will be thanked and congratulated when you talk to the powers that be. They get this now. It's really humbling to have people say, thank you for coming forward and congratulations on what you've done. But once they recognize that they needed their own second chances, like I said, maybe they didn't break the law, but that humility is infectious and it's attractive. And I want to encourage people to come forward and join Rob and us in this effort. And second, for us to when we raise our voice and amplify it, it's very hard for Rob to say, you know, this is wrong, because people think he's only talking about his own situation. But together, we can challenge the very morality, which I do believe it is immoral, to hold somebody in your care, custody, and control and charge them interest on fines and fees when they have no power to do it. It's there's no other way to describe it. It's impractical. It's unjust, but it's immoral. And we need to raise our voices together and kind of shout that a little bit to get people's attention. It's not that we have to pick on Republicans or conservatives or partisan politics at all, or even blame them for the failures, because usually these laws were put in place a generation or two ago. We just need to get their attention so they'll do it the right thing while they have the power and make the changes that we need to set people free, which in essence is setting our own culture free to the extent that you are able to gainfully enjoy your life going forward. The economy and the culture in the community all benefit, and everybody that you interact with there in Colorado. And so when we hold you back, Rob, we hold ourselves back. And I think people get that message, but we've got to rally together to bring that message to the powers that be today.
Yeah, definitely. These moments give me that's why I do what I do now, is because I want people to understand and hear. And like you said, it's not about me. It's about the challenges so many people go through. A lot of people I know that have had records, they just kind of look at it like, well, you know, let's just go get back and get locked up because I can't afford to take care of business on the outside because of, as you said, the 48,000 barriers that people that have spent time behind bars can endure. I want to touch on this as well. Is you mentioned as at the conference last year, you brought some amazing material to the forefront for communities to use to actually be educated on, like, the life of people that have spent time behind bars and how society can embrace them. So can you give a little plug for the Outrageous Justice programs that are out there? And, like, how do people get in touch with this material and get in touch with Prison Fellowship to get involved in their community? And so I guess touch on Outrageous Justice and then how people can get involved if they want.
Yeah, Outrageous Justice is a 6-week small group study guide. It's got a book that you can order up and read. It also has a study guide that you can share with people and go through it in a small group format and a video series. And it comes from the perspective of the person that's committed the crime, the victim of the crime, as well as the community perspective. And it has voices in there of people that run the prisons. It has the voices of people that have served time in prison. It has voices of victims. And it really goes to the values that are at stake, and it helps people educate you on how to find your voice and how to understand the mechanics of the justice system from a values orientation. It's called Outrageous Justice. And we absolutely need your listeners that whether it's their church or it's a business they own or it's a business they work for that they want to get engaged, come to, for all of this, Rob, come to prisonfellowship.org, prisonfellowship.org, just our name, /second chances, right? So prisonfellowship.org/second chances. And that's where they can lend their name. They can sign up in these different things. They can click on the advocacy space and become a volunteer and get engaged and try to help us lift all this up. Because Prison Fellowship's secret for success is that we try to equip people. Like, so you have this outrageous justice curriculum available to you to equip you and educate you. We try to engage people together with events around the country, like we do in Colorado and Minnesota and so many others. We have a prayer walk in Washington, D.C. with a lot of leaders going to be there on April 7th. All of our stuff, from Angel Tree to the in-prison programming that we do, is from people like the listeners of this podcast that get involved. We can't do it with our staff. Our staff is here to serve the greater church and the greater set of activists and advocates that we have out there, tens of thousands around the country, not to do all the work. And so we need you. We need you to get up off your couch. If justice is on your heart, if using your experience in addiction and recovery, that ninth step promise, using that experience to help other people is on your agenda, you know, we need you. So come join us. And it's a privilege at Prison Fellowship that we get to play at a pretty high game, pretty high level at the federal and the state level. People like Rob Lohman here, the host, that have experience going right to the powers that be at the Capitol in Colorado and speaking to them and walking out of there with the legislature acting. And so it's a pretty neat and action-packed way that we like to work with the people that get involved. And I'd encourage all your listeners to give it a shot and come and visit us and read up more about what we're doing.
That's great, Craig. I appreciate you spending time with us today. It was a fun interview to kind of hear more about you and the great thing about the Outrageous Justice videos is they can see you, Craig, on the videos talking to them. Like, it's live, you know, it's great. So
there you go.
Yeah, there you go. There you go.
More of me.
You can get real with Craig. But any kind of last, I mean, that was a great kind of end there, but is there any kind of last little thing you want to say to everybody before we kind of wrap up?
No, just that my hopes and dreams are alongside yours. I like to tell people, I think we all have the same size hopes and dreams, and that includes the people that are in prison today. And so let's just go forward and with smiles on our faces and gratitude for where we are today and try to put one foot in front of the next.
All right. Well, thanks for your time, Craig. And all this information will be up on the website. We'll have your a link to your highly functional memoir, which I think would be really great if people tapped into that too, and link to Prison Fellowship, and they can get plugged in however they want. And you have an amazing day, and thanks for chiming in today.
Thank you, brother. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Beyond the Bars Radio Podcast. Hopefully you picked up another wisdom of nugget. I mean another nugget of wisdom along the way. Because they always say that if you share what you learned within 48 hours, you not only have a great chance of actually retaining some information, but you might actually impact a life around you. Because you never know who might need a hand up or who might be struggling in their life. So share what you can, change a life around. Speaking of changing lives, we want to give a big shout out to a couple of our sponsors. Thank you so much to Lifted from the Rut. Where Lifted from the Rut provides intervention and addiction recovery services to help individuals, families, or businesses that might have a loved one struggling with addiction and get them on that path to recovery. We also want to say a big thank you to The Rock Transformational House, where it is a 7-month program for men between the ages of 40 and 65 that are either coming out of addiction or they're actually maybe in a midlife crisis. And they just want to turn their life around and focus their heart and their eyes on Jesus Christ. Thank you so much to our sponsors, so much for our listeners, and we always love to hear from our listeners. So please make sure that you send us a message through beyondthebarsradio.com or leave a comment on this podcast. We look forward to connecting with you next time, and bring a friend.